Disclaimer: this episode of Dead Souls may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Before we begin, in covering this episode from history, I have received a lot of interesting and somewhat colourful messages from members of the public. Some accusing me of being, quote, a Zionist, a pro-Israel genocide supporter, and a right-wing encourager of the murder of innocent women and children. Well, thanks for those messages. But to be clear, the subject of this two-part series is purely factual. I am sharing hard facts about a historic series of events. At no point in the last episode, or in this one, do I claim to support any side in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Like all subjects which I discuss on this channel, I am merely reporting factual information in a neutral and unbiased manner. I am discussing the facts of a past incident that occurred during our shared dark history. I hope that's clear, and I appreciate your understanding. Thank you, everyone. In the first part of this series, I covered the events of September 5th, 1972 at the Olympic Village in Munich, Germany. Eight members of the Palestinian terrorist organization named Black September killed two Israeli athletes and took nine others hostage. Following tense negotiations between the terrorists and the West German authorities, the Black September operatives and their nine hostages are about to leave the Olympic Village and head to the airport to escape Germany for a friendly Arab country. Please ensure you listen to part one in this series before progressing with tonight's episode. It just makes more sense.
This is Peter Jennings in the Olympic Village. The Olympic Village is built on various levels, and underneath Building 31, and underneath, in fact, all of the buildings here, there is a network of roads. Those alleyways now have been used to bring in a fairly massive security force, including armored cars, and just a short while ago, Howard Cosell noticed that there was considerable activity there.
Over the recent 25 to 30 minutes, there was a flurry of activity. Cars were speeding off, and we now have a corridor or avenue of departure available to the Arabs should a deal have been made and should they be coming out as now seems likely. So there is a quiet now and an expectancy.
The hostages are transported to the waiting helicopters by bus. The Black September operatives keeping their guns firmly positioned on the Jewish prisoners. The bus arrives at the waiting helicopters and Issa jumps out to inspect their transport for any set traps awaiting them. The Huey helicopters are to be piloted by two German airmen each. The airmen have volunteered for this mission with the agreement from the Black September militants that they will not be taken hostage. Quite optimistic and trusting on their part, possibly. Content with the transport, Issa motions for the rest of his men and the Israelis to board the choppers in full view of spectators and television cameras. The two helicopters lift off at 10:21 p.m. precisely, followed soon after by a third Huey helicopter carrying the West German negotiation team. The Germans count the number of militants and are shocked to make a very surprising discovery. All day, the negotiators were under the impression that there were five militants. All of their plans were set around there being just five militants, but they have now realized that there are actually eight. Waiting at Fürstenfeldbruck Airfield, preparing to ambush Black September, are only five police snipers and officers armed only with revolvers. The West German police will be outgunned by the militants, but it is too late to change the plan now. The helicopters will be arriving in just a matter of minutes. The plan is for the two helicopters to land in front of the main airfield administration building and control tower. The area will be lit by basic, though fairly large, spotlights. Once the Hueys have both sat down, Issa agreed to let the helicopter crews go before he and another militant walk across the tarmac to inspect their transport. A Boeing 727 passenger airliner has been borrowed from Lufthansa Airlines and is parked with its engine idling a short distance away from the helicopter landing zone. Inside the jet, a 60 Munich police officers disguised as Lufthansa aircrew with instructions to kill or capture the two Black September members when they board the airliner for inspection. This plan, of course, is all whilst they still believe that there are only 5 militants in total. The 5 police snipers perched in and around the main building will take down the remaining 3 still within the helicopters, and assault vehicles will rush in and rescue the hostages. The rescue plan has already fallen apart before the Hueys even arrive, however. Police officer Reinhold Reich is in charge of the 16-man crew aboard the 727, and he has serious reservations about the plan. Their disguises, for starters, aren't very good, and the militants will almost certainly see that straight away, let alone wondering why there is such a large amount of aircrew on the flight. Reich is also aghast to learn that the airliner is fully loaded with 10,000 gallons of jet fuel, even though the West Germans have no intention of letting the aircraft leave. Thus, he and his men are sitting inside a massive bomb if a firefight breaks out and ignites the fuel tank. His men also only have 3 submachine guns and a service revolver to which to fight the militants. Understandably, the German police feel extremely anxious about the whole plan. With the helicopters now only 2 minutes away, and with such low probability of success, Reich calls for a vote on whether to abandon the aircraft and subsequent mission. Every man aboard votes in favour of leaving the 727, and the officers quickly begin disembarking and running for their lives. Reich runs to find Deputy Chief George Wolf to inform him of their decision. A stunned Wolf literally shouts, quote,
"What the fuck am I supposed to do now?"
The remaining 5 sharpshooters had no special sniper training, no radio communication, and no telescopic or infrared sights, which, you might say, are pretty essential for a sniper. At 10:30 p.m., just as the helicopters are coming into land, a central component to the plan has collapsed. The sniper team at Fürstenfeldbruck has also not been told of the additional 3 militants. There is no time to improvise a backup plan. The operation will have to go ahead as is, with the planners hoping for the best. The helicopter carrying the negotiating team from the Olympic Village lands first, and the 2 Israeli observers are immediately concerned by the lack of visibility. The 2 helicopters carrying the hostages and the militants set down shortly after. Issa and his men are immediately suspicious and gingerly exit the helicopters as the rotor blades slow to a stop. The 4 German airmen who piloted the helicopters get out and begin walking away, only for the militants to raise their AK-47s towards them. What kind of world do we live in, where you can't trust the word of a terrorist, eh? The negotiating team is watching from the second floor of the main building and are stunned by the development. The militants now have 13 hostages. Issa and his deputy, Tony, walk across the tarmac to check the 727 over for traps, while the German airmen are held at gunpoint. Meanwhile, the 5 police snipers are having their own problems. The Hueys were supposed to land with their noses facing away from the main building, so the snipers could have a clear view into their interior. But they instead landed with the noses facing towards the snipers, putting the hostages in the crossfire. The snipers are trying to adjust their positions when Issa and Tony run out of the airplane. When the terrorists had entered the empty plane, they quickly realized it was a trap and ran out and back to the helicopters. The police sharpshooters open fire, and a blazing shootout quickly erupts. The militants at the helicopter raise their weapons and prepare to kill the hostages. Knowing it's now or never, George Wolf gives the order to open fire. The 2 militants guarding the helicopter pilots are both hit and fall to the ground, although only one is killed. The helicopter crewmen get up and begin running in opposite directions, while another sniper targets Issa and Tony, who are halfway back across the tarmac. Tony is hit in the leg and collapses, while Issa is unharmed. He and the rest of the Black September group duck behind the helicopters for cover and return fire with their AK-47s. All hell has broken loose.
The latest word we get from the airport is that, quote, all hell has broken loose out there, that there is still shooting going on.
The negotiating team on the second floor dives for cover, with Genscher almost killed by a hail of stray bullets. A police officer on the first floor, Anton Fliegerbauer, is firing his MP5 at the militants when he is shot in the head and killed instantly. The German sniper firing from a low wall opposite to the helicopters and main building now finds himself under fire. The sniper ducks for cover as the militants now begin throwing grenades in every direction, including his. One of the helicopter pilots dives behind the wall to hide with the sniper while the firefight continues. Another militant is killed, but the lack of lighting means neither side can see the other, and neither can identify if they are making any impact on the enemy. It would be really useful if the snipers had radios and could communicate. At 10:55 p.m., 20 minutes after the shooting had started, one of the senior police officers now realizes that the outgunned Germans will need more support, and he radios for armored vehicles, only to be told that they are still parked at the Olympic Village, 24 miles away. Hiding beneath a desk in the main building, Mossad Chief Zemir pleads with Interior Minister Genscher and Bavarian Prime Minister Franz Josef Strauss to do something, to do more. They stated, quote,
"We can't do anything. This is not within our authority. This is a federal affair."
Finally, an enraged Zemir demands a megaphone to speak with the militants himself and to try to defuse the situation. The West Germans finally relent, and Victor Cohen is sent to the roof with a megaphone. He shouts at the militants in Arabic, quote,
"Stop firing. The plane is ready for you as you want. If you carry on, you'll be hurt or killed. Please stop firing."
The Black September operatives respond by spraying machine gun fire at the roof, narrowly missing Cohen. Both sides continue taking pot shots at one another for over an hour. Meanwhile, hundreds of members of the public descend on the airfield, determined to get a look at the firefight being reported on the news. The roads around the airfield are blocked tight with traffic, and the outer perimeter fence is surrounded by the public and television crews. Ulrich Wegener attempts to rally the police officers who are meekly standing around without their guns even being drawn. "What are you going to do? You have to move your people there and pull out the hostages. Do something," he screams at them. But George Wolf had told the officers not to fire at the militants unless they are personally threatened. There are a lot of cowards at the airfield that night, it seems. Wolf calls for an assault group of more heavily armed police officers to arrive by helicopter, but this team doesn't arrive until 11:34 p.m. and the pilot lands more than a mile away from the firefight. Nervous and inexperienced, the assault group refused to take part in the battle. At 11:55 p.m., four armored cars, which had been at the Olympic Village, finally arrived at the scene and begin moving into position at 12:01 a.m. It has taken more than an hour for this armored support to arrive. The hostages have been sitting in the helicopters for the entire duration of the gun battle, sensing that at any moment they are about to be overrun and killed. Eventually, the militants resort to their last option. Acting on Issa's orders, one of the gunmen jumps into the helicopter which was carrying four of the hostages. He sprays the Israelis with machine gun fire, killing all inside. He then jumps out and tosses a grenade into the Huey before being shot dead by a sniper. The grenade explodes. Issa is almost instantaneously shot and killed by another sniper. The Huey erupts into a fireball, burning alive all four hostages, who are at this point fighting for their lives after the previous blast of gunfire. The scene is repeated at the other helicopter. A militant jumps into the crew compartment and executes the five hostages inside by AK-47 at point-blank range. Ulrich Wegener would tell an interviewer in 1999 that he could still hear the screams of the hostages as they burned. One of the militants then tried to escape, sprinting away from the main buildings, but he runs right into the line of sight of the sniper positioned at ground level behind a low wall. The sniper shoots him in the head. He dies instantly, but one of the armored car crew sees the sniper and believes he is one of the militants. In another example of how this operation was a complete shitstorm, the armored car opens fire, wounding both the sniper and the helicopter pilot who had taken cover next to him. A group of unarmed German firefighters have been waiting at the airfield firehouse for instructions, but none have been received since the battle began. When the easterly most situated helicopter explodes, the frustrated firemen decide to act to save the hostages, even though they are unaware it's already too late. The airbase fire engine drives into the middle of the firefight with four militants still alive and firing back from under the westernmost helicopter. The fire engines stop a short distance from the burning Huey, and the firefighters begin spraying the area with foam to extinguish the flames. The militants sheltering under the other Huey now open fire on the firefighters, hitting none but forcing them to retreat. Now the police snipers on the control tower aim for the muzzle flashes from the terrorists and take out another of them. It is not until 12:30 a.m. that the gunfire finally stops, 2 hours after the hostages had arrived at the airbase. The two Israeli officials, along with dozens of West German policemen, rush out of the airfield building towards the helicopters, hoping that some of the hostages have somehow survived. An optimist, and somewhat naive hope, perhaps. It is Victor Cohen who is the first to get to the Huey, which of the two was unburned. Cohen stated, quote,
"I looked into the helicopter, hoping that some of the hostages were alive, and I saw all of them sitting there. They were bound by rope, and all of them were clearly dead, riddled with bullets."
Munich Police Chief Manfred Schreiber is immediately overcome by grief. However, the police officers who were counting the corpses discover that three of the militants are missing. This triggers a frantic search, with the armored cars racing away to find the three Black September operatives. Two are quickly found hiding within the anti-fire foam which had covered the burned helicopter. The other is apprehended, trying to flee the scene on foot amidst the chaos and hundreds of people who are now descending upon the location. The rescue attempt is a complete failure. All hostages, along with a police officer, have been killed, while several more officers have been wounded. Five of the eight militants are dead, with the remaining three now in police custody. The Reuters news agency mistakenly releases a wire report announcing that all Israeli hostages have been freed. But this is quickly corrected.
"I'm glad that as far as we can see now, this police action was successful. Of course, it's an unfortunate interruption of the Olympic Games. But, I mean, if all that comes out as we hope it will come out or has come out, I think it will be forgotten after a few weeks."
The optimism proved too premature.
"Originally, they said that the hostages were safe. Now that has been changed. And an Olympic spokesman said, we are afraid the information given so far is too optimistic. That's where we seem to stand."
As the evening went on, the news gradually got worse.
"We keep hearing that the indications are not good, that Johnny Klein may have very bad news."
And then finally, after 3 a.m. German time, ABC's Jim McKay broadcast this now famous message.
"When I was a kid, my father used to say, our greatest hopes and our worst fears are seldom realized. Our worst fears have been realized tonight. They have now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. 9 were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone."
The Black September massacre of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics stuns the entire world. After an hour of intense celebration in the Olympic Village and in Israel, after everyone thought the hostages had been freed, the horrible truth is revealed. A quick and solemn grief washes over everyone as the truth hits them. After hearing the false report, Zvi Zamir placed a call to Golda Meir and tells the Prime Minister, quote, "Golda, I have bad news. We just returned from the airport. All 9 were killed. Not one was saved." A correction issued by Reuters at 3:17 a.m. finally confirmed that all hostages had been killed. Another mishap in a long line of failures during this entire affair. IOC President Avery Brundage once again stubbornly refuses to let the massacre affect the Olympic Games. But regardless, the Games are suspended for 34 hours, the longest he will entertain a pause, and a memorial service is held the following day. Brundage's speech at the service makes little reference to those killed and outrages the Israeli families by bizarrely equating the hostages' plight to Rhodesia being barred from the Games for racism. The rest of the Israeli athletes withdraw from the Olympics, along with members of several other Olympic teams, each fearful of repeat attacks. But despite the concerns, the Olympics resume on the 7th of September, and the Games conclude 4 days later. The decision to have little to no security at the Olympic Village would become heavily criticized, as was the German government's weak response to the crisis. The terrorist incident becomes the sole talking point for the Games, overshadowing any and all athletic achievements. The catastrophe quickly became another shameful episode in Germany's history, in that the rescue operation was a criminally shambolic failure. The West German government quickly made moves to cover up their litany of mistakes. They prevented the victims' families from accessing autopsy reports and other key documents, citing German national security. The German government admitted themselves in 1994 that a concerted effort to draw a veil over certain truths had been made at the time. Germany was desperate to recover its reputation following the dark period of Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, so they needed the stain of Munich to go away quickly, and with as little commotion as possible. But after 20 years of constant pressure from Israel, an anonymous Bavarian government worker leaked documents to the victim's family's lawyer in 1993. Following the leak, a 10-year period of legal battles followed before the German government would finally admit responsibility for the disaster. They settled with the families for 3 million euros each. In the immediate aftermath of the hostage crisis, Israel responded by bombing 10 Palestinian Liberation Organization camps on the 8th of September 1973. The bomb raids killed more than 200 civilians. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, is a commandment found in the Hebrew Bible, or the Torah. Specifically within the book of Exodus, verse 21, chapters 23 to 27. It expresses the principle of reciprocal justice, measure for measure. The law of exact retaliation or reciprocal justice states that a person who has injured another person is to be penalized to a similar degree by the injured party. The Torah discusses a form of direct reciprocal justice with the phrase ayin tachat ayin. Most Jews do not believe in literal physical retaliation to those who have wronged them. They follow the rule of law like everybody else. However, some traditional and hardline Jews, much like hardline followers of Islam and Christianity, will follow the word of their holy book, in this case the Torah, to a T, and will use these ancient verses to justify their fanaticism. Fanaticism, for example, shown by some far right-wing governments. With this in mind, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir created a committee to formulate a more wide-reaching response in 1973. This committee recommends a broad assassination campaign against PLO and Black September militants. The campaign is to seek the ultimate revenge for the treatment of their athletes on the world stage. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Mayer is initially reluctant to take such extreme measures of retaliation, however. But further incidents force her hand. On Sunday, the 29th of October 1972, not even 8 weeks after the Munich Olympic attack, a Lufthansa passenger jet on its way from Damascus in Syria to Frankfurt, Germany, is hijacked by two terrorists as it left Beirut Airport. There were only 11 passengers on board, all of which were male. The pilot was told to fly to Munich, where the terrorists' subsequent demands were relayed to Bonn, the West German capital and seat of government at the time. The hijacked Lufthansa jet was a Boeing 727, originally manufactured in 1964. Its serial number was 18364. The aircraft had originated at Damascus International Airport early that same morning. It took off with 7 crew members and 0 passengers. At the flight's first stopover in Beirut, 13 people boarded, 9 Arabs, 2 Americans, 1 German, a Frenchman, and a Spanish citizen. The plane took off from Beirut International Airport at 6:01 a.m. Less than 15 minutes into the flight, 2 of the Arab passengers threatened to blow up the aircraft using explosives which had been hidden in the first class cabin. The explosives had actually been smuggled and hidden aboard the plane before it left Damascus that morning. But more on that in a moment. The terrorists' demands were simple. They wanted the release of Adnan Al-Gashi, Jamal Al-Gashi, and Mohammed Safadi, the members of Black September who survived the Munich Olympic hostage-taking, who were being held in a German prison. The plane initially stopped to refuel at Nicosia International Airport in Cyprus, following which the pilots were forced to head towards Munich's Riem Airport. But the plan that the hijackers had in mind hit a snag almost right away. The hijackers initially hoped to exchange their hostages for the Black September operatives in Munich. However, at around midday while entering Austrian airspace, it was identified that the German authorities could not complete the exchange in time and as per the hijackers' original plan. Thus, the plan changed. The Lufthansa crew were told to divert to Zagreb International Airport in Yugoslavia. German authorities rushed to meet this change in plan on time and before the aircraft would eventually run out of fuel. There had been no hesitation from the German authorities to comply with the demands of the hijackers. They were certain not to have a repeat of the disaster at Munich a few weeks prior. 20 minutes after the 3 Black September members had arrived at Zagreb Airport, the Lufthansa jet landed. The transfer took place at around 6:05 p.m. without issue. After refueling once again, the Lufthansa flight departed at 6:50 p.m. headed for Tripoli in Libya. It arrived at Tripoli International Airport just after 9 p.m. local time, where the 18 hostages aboard were finally set free. The 3 liberated Black September attackers were immediately granted asylum by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. At no point throughout the entire incident were the Israelis consulted in the response or were spoken to in regard to what was happening. There was outrage in Israel. A furious Golda Meir greenlights the assassination campaign against Black September by Mossad. It is codenamed Operation Bayonet, often nicknamed Operation Wrath of God. Over the next 20 years, Mossad hunted down and killed dozens of PLO militants with connections to the Munich massacre. The final assassination as part of the operation being in 1992 in Paris, France. Several hours before each assassination took place, the family of each target would receive anonymously sent flowers with a condolence card. Each card read, quote, "A reminder, we do not forget or forgive." Operation Wrath of God is an episode in itself, and perhaps we will go into much more detail in the future if you guys want to hear that. Let us know. Whilst Mossad killed several prominent Palestinians during the operation, they never managed to kill the mastermind behind Munich, namely Abu Daoud. Instead, Daoud died on July 3rd, 2010 of kidney failure at a Damascus hospital in Syria. The circumstances surrounding the details of the Lufthansa Flight 615 hijacking were considered highly suspicious for many years. Why were there such few passengers on the large jet? Why were there no women or children? How were the explosives smuggled aboard and by whom? Why didn't the German government attempt to negotiate or stop the hijackers? Why were they so hasty to hand over the three Black September prisoners? Many conspiracies emerged from the events of that day. In the late 1990s, one of the Black September operatives, Jamal Al-Ghashi, still in hiding in Libya, revealed that the entire hijacking was a setup. It was arranged by the West German government in collusion with members of Black September. Court documents between the families of the hostages and the German government from 1998 reveal that this claim was actually true. The German government had hoped that by appeasing the terrorists, they could avoid all future terrorist activity in their country and sidestep any future international embarrassment. That backfired only 5 years later, when further Palestinian terrorist attacks occurred in Germany. Dead Souls is researched, written, produced and hosted by me, Jamie Black, with music by Mark Butler and Coag. Dead Souls is not part of any network or corporation and is entirely independent. Therefore, our views are completely free from any bias or censorship. For more information about our show, follow us on Twitter at Dead Soulscast and Instagram at dead_souls_podcast. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/deadsouls. For $2 a month, you will get access to exclusive ad-free episodes only for Patreon supporters and exclusive access to written articles, blogs, and research. You may have noticed that sometimes our podcast doesn't appear on your YouTube feed, and very often, our podcasts get age-restricted or removed altogether. This isn't by accident. We cover topics that are not always algorithm-friendly, and the big corporations don't love it when we talk about certain topics or have certain conversations, especially the kind that challenge mainstream narratives. This is another reason we have created our Patreon. It is a space where we can post full, unfiltered and uncensored topics that the big platforms and mainstream media don't always like. Proceeds from our Patreon go directly to supporting us, our show, our research, and keeping the lights on here at Dead Souls HQ. Go check it out. patreon.com/deadsouls. That's it, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Good night, everyone.